Okay.
What is this? This is a stupid microphone. Okay. I think it needs lots of love, I guess. Okay. So please sit down, ladies and gentlemen. It is the last stepstone in today's conference, I would say. It's the grand panel. It's called of Hypercrotch and Nanobot. Nobody actually on the panel knew about the title, although it was on the website for like a month or something like that, but whatever, okay? So,
we totally all saw the title.
Good. So, okay. My general idea about the panel here is like not to, like, I don't want to force you in like a direction. I generally wanted to like round up today's like presentations, and in general I wanted to go back to the general topic of this year's Ars Electronica of intercourse and intracourse. So genetics, biotechnology, wetware, whatever there is, the future of sex in the sleaziest way possible. I don't know. Okay, so I would like to introduce our panelists. On the far right side, and that's of course not a political thing, you know. On the far right side, we have the wonderful Violet Blue. She is a sex blogger, sex celebrity, and last year you misheard my thing. I think I said like sex educator, and you understood sex agitator. But I think sex agitator is actually way better. You should put that on your like on your blurb on your site. I think that's good. Okay. Ah, yeah, and use the microphone. I'm very BDSM-y about microphones here.
Is it on?
Because yeah, we might actually get a little bit of funding of the Austrian government, maybe afterwards, but then we have to record all this stuff and put it online, so that's why we are recording the whole thing here. And of course there is the webcam somewhere up there, and I hope that someone will actually see us. Okay, so we have Violet Blue. We have Ella Seida, I hope I pronounced it correctly. Yeah. And she was pretty much our keynote speaker today, and she talked about the future of sex. I mean, that's, I guess, why you're
here
on the
future of sex, the future of designing sex.
Okay. We have Carol Queen, who is, I mean, who doesn't know Carol Queen? Aww. But Carol Queen, she's running the Center for Sex and Culture. She's a sex agitator too, I guess. She has problem with the Catholic Church at the moment, I've heard.
Yeah.
We can talk about that later on concerning like the future, and the Catholic Church will be there anyways. Whatever future we can imagine, there is a Catholic Church there.
Not every future.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about it later. We have.
I'm also the Luddite on the panel, people. Yeah. Everybody's going to say really smart things, and I'm going to go, I'll have to go look that up later.
I mean, we have like small gadgets and stuff, and we cannot even. No, whatever. So we have Rose White.
Hello.
You are a sociologist. So
I am a sociologist.
And you're doing lots of research. I mean, you're in a certain way like a standard, an Ars Electronica standard too. But last year she actually wanted to give a talk at Ars Electronica, but she had to like undergo surgery. That was pretty bad.
It was really a kind of extreme body modification. I removed an organ, but didn't do it on stage.
And even like a penis-shaped appendix.
But just an appendix. Instead of giving the talk at Ars, I gave it at the Chaos Communications Congress to a delightful standing room crowd in the main hall. So that was turned out great.
And of course, it's in the book. So
it's in the book.
Yeah,
which you should buy.
So thanks a lot, Rose, for being here. We have Tatiana Batticelli. Batticelli, okay, very good. She's actually, you're based in Denmark, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you I'm are Italian. From, it, and you, I think we should, yeah.
Okay, I'm Italian, but I'm based in Denmark, and now I'm living in San Francisco for 4 months, because I'm doing research at Stanford University. So yeah, I'm traveling a lot, kind of nomadic entity.
And you're one of the heads or curators of the Come to Cut porn film festival that was based in Berlin and now might move somewhere else, but we'll talk about that later. And we have Saul Albert. And Saul Albert is actually a member of the faculty of the Open University. Am I
close? The Faculty of Faculty, or alternatively Physical Education, at the University of Openness. The Open University is a very august and respected institution in the United Kingdom, and the University of Openness is its somewhat less reputable counterpart.
Tell us a little bit about, let's start with you, I guess, yeah? So tell us a little bit about the University of Openness.
Sure. The University of Openness is a self-institution for research. It's for research into methods of autodidactic education. And basically, in 2002, it took some of the pedagogical principles of the open source movement and applied them to a kind of liberal arts education model in an abandoned town hall building in East London. And a whole lot of different groups converged around this space and started teaching each other all kinds of stuff. The Faculty of Physical Education started with how to escape paying train fares by crouching and hiding in between, that kind of... I think that method was called the extreme physical fuck and involved some sort of masturbation process to alleviate the symptoms of crouching in between the two chairs. So anyway, it kind of evolved and turned into quite a large scale and interesting and very diverse university institution with I think about 40 faculties and lots of different research projects, all kinds of stuff. I mean, you can look it up, you can Google it, University of Openness, and you'll find all kinds of interesting things. Anyway, the Faculty of Faculty or physical education, there was kind of an argument that went on, began I think in 2003, 2004. And all kinds of experimentation was done, and I think I won't go on too long because there's a big panel. But I think if you check out the wiki, you'll find all kinds of interesting approaches to education, which maybe have been proved wrong now. Now that kind of social software has become mainstream, or it's become Web 2.0. And a lot of the kinds of communications and aspirations that started in the early days of open source going mainstream have kind of dissipated. So it's been proved wrong, which actually just makes it more interesting to me. So although it's been in remission for a couple of years, I think the University of Openness is about to turn malignant again and start doing stuff. So,
okay, of course, yeah.
What's the difference between the University of Openness and a sex cult?
I don't know, actually. I don't think there is one at all.
Okay.
I mean, no. I've actually never been part of the sex cult, so you'll have to we'll have to swap notes.
It's a sign of indoctrination, actually.
Okay.
They don't know.
Okay, Tatiana.
Yep. So maybe I could do like a parallelism between open technology and pornography, also because so I can maybe answer to you and connect to what you say, and also attach to what you said before, so about Come to Cut, because just to give some example that maybe could be also an input for future discussion, we defined this festival as a kind of open pornography festival. And it's actually was I invented this together with Gaia Novati, that is another Italian woman from Berlin. And somehow it, for us, was kind of open sexual university in the sense that, of course, was not a long-term university, but was something happening in 3 days. And the people have the possibility to create a short porn movie in just 3 days and also edit at the same time. And so we call it a porn marathon because it was addressing really normal people to do something with pornography, but at the same time also try to reinvent the concept. So it's open pornography because it's like an open concept that everybody can rewrite and personalize through different body, minds, and like cross experiments.
Okay, so then my next question would be for Rose, okay? So we live, I mean, at least I'm talking about the Western world or the westernized world. So I'm not talking about Iran or stuff where you actually get killed because you're homosexual or stuff like that. So we have always like to divide that like in this like openish, liberalish thing that's going on in the Western world. So there's lots of talking about the mainstreaming of porn. There are many, many artists out there who use porn as their medium in a certain way. And if we talk about the future of sex, and if we talk about the future of humanity, about like heterosexism, stuff like that. So how does, like, as a scholar in sociology, how does that fit together? Like the future of sex and the future of porn and the future of like a better world. I don't know. A possibly better world or a way to change it. I don't know.
It was already on. Speaking as an academic and speaking personally, what I see happening with consumption of porn and in younger cohorts are that there's, picking up again on the theme of openness, that there is much more openness and flexibility about, say, gender roles in porn and or in sexual behavior, and thus more openness in looking at porn where there's fluidity. And so when I look at a young pornographer like furry girl, Sabrina, who's here, and some of her porn sites and the porn that she makes, I think about the people consuming that porn and or a site like NoFo, where there's a lot of gender queerness. And I'd like to think that the sex acts that are going on there and the people who are excited by them are part of the future that Ella is talking about and that Annalie was sharing with us. The idea that we're sort of evolving away from a kind of dichotomous setup into just exploring what we enjoy.
Okay, so my question for Carol would be, isn't like 99% of porn out there like boring, heteronormative stuff? And so is there a revolution in porn out there on the horizon? I don't know.
What's the library at CSC?
Well, I'll tell you, there are two ways to answer that question. And the first way is yes. That's the first way. The other way is a little more nuanced. I'm gonna give a little more attention to that. The other way to answer that question is yes, but a lot of what's in it is intensely erotically appealing to many people, sometimes only snippets, sometimes only certain elements, sometimes only certain performers. And as I think Susie Bright wrote about 20 years ago, women have historically looked at male-oriented porn and just taken the stuff, just sort of spaced out on all the other dreck that's part of the porn movie and pulled the stuff out to focus on and watch that they wanted to see. And I think that still continues to be true, although there are many more things now that at least are putatively women-focused and desired that women will buy into them. Some women do, some women still don't find porn that they resonate with, as do some men and transgendered people not find that. But the thing that I think is really important is that some people always have, as long as there's been any kind of technology they could control, make porn out of mass-produced porn that was for them. The Institute for Advanced Study of Human Sexuality, where I got my PhD, the Center for Sex and Culture that I co-founded and curate. We both have items in our collections where people used their record switch judiciously to pull either pieces out of television commercials that they thought were hot, or picking out scenes that they liked in pornos and looping them so that they were longer, or things that the computer... I said I was a Luddite, but I do know that computers exist. And I do know the computer makes this process of auto-editing easier and will make it easier and easier over time. In fact, I wouldn't be at all surprised if there were some mass market editing programs that really help people do that. I know that there are already some of the things that, that, that savvy people know about already. But I think that at the same time that kids are going to be able to make their lightsabers raise into the air and do backflips, that there will be things that their slightly older brothers and sisters and dads' moms can use to do the kind of porn that they want. So that's one piece. I think individuals desire erotic entertainment, and they want to see reflections of themselves or their erotic interests in the media that they consume. So that's not going to go away. The future, I think, is going to hold more people who, especially because they have been able to go on the internet and see alt porn of various kinds, however you would want to talk about that. I mean, there are many ways of thinking about that. Because they know it's out there, there will be more markets that are growing to meet that knowledge. And Good Vibrations, where I, of course, have been involved since dinosaurs ruled the earth, is exploring some ideas around that. So you'll see those things soon. And I'm sure we're not going to be the last. I don't even know if we're going to be the biggest. So we'll see what happens with that. But I am completely sure that as we have more individually easily usable technology, more of that is going to be sexualized in a customized way. I just don't have any doubt of that at all.
It was really interesting because as part of the film festival that was co-hosted by Ars Electronica, Monochrome and Blowfish, we showed a documentary from 2001 called Love Machine. And you remember, you were part of it. You were in Love Machine, yeah? Uh-huh. And it was kind of interesting to see, like, it was like, it's nine, we wanted to show the documentary because, first of all, it's on a certain level completely outdated, because most of the machines you see there, I mean, they are 9 years old, and like, especially in robotics, like 9 years, that's a long time. At the, like, but then again, many things that were said in the documentary were still like pretty much like what we would actually discuss right now, like 9 years later. So, and I remember that Ella, you were sitting there in the back in the film festival writing your talk for today. and like only paying like half, like 50% of attention to the documentary. But you had a couple of like outbursts of like, oh no. I was interested. So, I mean, You see the gap, like the last 10 years, the next 10 years. So what's your perspective on that, especially because you talked today about the future of sex in your presentation?
Well, as far as the future of sex with robots goes, one of the things I found really interesting about that documentary was specifically that they chose to focus exclusively on people trying to build robots that looked like people and that worked like people. Mm-hmm. And I was really curious, where are all the people who want to sleep with robots that look like robots? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's...
Internet.
Yeah, but it
That was Kyle.
Kyle wants to sleep with the internet, yes.
Yeah.
I know that.
So I think that's one thing which will start to become interesting. Okay, so once we get, you know, sex toys which are kind of entering into that uncanny valley territory, at what point do we stop trying to purely emulate? At what point do we say, okay, well, yeah, I'm going to create something else which is still hot, but which isn't trying to be quite exactly human? You know, one of the other things that we were talking a little bit about during the film was, you know, what does it look like when you build robots that are trying to have sex with other robots? You know, can you build, you know, either as an art piece, something else? You know, robots that are exchanging, you know, means of reproduction. They're like exchanging their own robotic DNA with each other, you know, either as art, as something somewhere between a sex toy and art, you know, or as something actually useful. You know, can you enable that kind of sexual style reproduction in robots? Does that, you know, is that a useful set of techniques to bring to bear for actual robotics work?
It's almost like a Darwinian art piece.
Yeah.
I don't know. I remember, yeah, there's one guy who pretty much founded Real Doll. He's in the documentary.
Yeah.
And he's talking that he started it as like pieces of art, and he wanted to sell it for the art market. And nobody was really interested in like realistic looking, like creepy, like real dolls for like sitting in like in somewhere in the corner of the living room
art
and stuff.
Corpses.
And and more and more people were interested in actually having sex with the real dolls. And he was, because he I think in at least in the, he's portraying himself in the documentary as an artist who is kind of like, nobody understands me. I want to make pieces of art and they just want to fuck it. And we were talking about like a possibility of like future of art installations you can actually have sexual intercourse with, who do not need to like look like female or male, like and android, whatever things, but just like some. I really would like to go to the Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco and fuck an installation there. I mean, I kind of can see that. So maybe completely like an abstract kind of thing with like, I don't know, a couple of holes.
So they've actually got this piece on display right now, which is this wall, which was made out of plaster and kind of bulging fabric that actually ends up, you know, it has lots of holes in it. It's unfortunately quite stiff, but you know, I mean, you know, you could make something like that. It was a bit more flexible, spray some lube on it, you know.
I mean, there's the new world of new fabrics out there, so yeah, I don't know. But I mean, the new world, new fabrics, Violet.
I mean, thinking about all that, you know, thinking that we could actually make the better fuck machine if we're not trying to make it human is a really, really tantalizing concept. Not just because of all the creepiness of the uncanny valley, which is appealing for a subset of people, myself included. But I was doing a podcast last night and someone was asking a question about flavored lubes for a cooking podcast that we were doing. And I was talking about when working at Good Vibrations and testing and tasting all the disgusting flavored lubes that we carried.
I think
and
I need a Bud Light now.
So for instance, like this, be it lemon flavored, the dick is not going to taste like a lemon. It's going to taste like a rubber piece of lemon. It's going to be gross and warm. But we found that things that tasted like something artificial, like the flavor of bubblegum, which was made to be an artificial flavor, tasted fantastic because it was made to be fake. And so that's sort of the concept I'm thinking of, like when thinking of, you know, what if we start designing fucking machines not to replicate necessarily the human-to-human experience, but the human-to-robot experience, and how much more effective in orgasm and experience those machines can be. And it also, reminds me of when last year we were talking with Thomas Roche, talking about the appeal of fucking machines and why fucking machines as a site is so appealing and why there are so many female members, so many like subscribers that are female. And it's because of the pure relationship of the woman to the machine itself. It's not a woman and a man. It's not a woman and another woman. It's a woman and a machine, and she's getting off purely for her own pleasure. And something about that is exactly what works for a lot of people. So, and also it's hardcore. Yes, Heartcore Productions is your new Good Vibrations
hardcore,
line of videos.
Microphone. Yeah. We need it for recording.
Oh, right. Yeah. We're the video names that Violet reminds me to say out are Heartcore, Pleasure Ed, which is my part, and Real Queer, R-E-E-L, Queer. And you wanted to say something, didn't you? I did too, but you were jumping first.
I was jumping first. So there was another guy in the Love Machine documentary who, while he was talking, had a mechanical hand that he was wearing. It was
like
a sort
claws,
of a
almost
sort of
claws.
Wolverine
hand,
and he kept making this sort of snick, snick Wolverine noise while he was talking. And he had all this machismo while he talked, as opposed to the real doll creator, who had, as Johannes said, a sort of sense of, you want to fuck my art, whereas the Wolverine fellow was like, yeah, I've made a robot for you to fuck, and
I want to give pleasure to as many women as possible.
And you know, I've been talking to my friends and I talked to them about how much you would pay, you know, over your lifetime about to fuck, you know. And so he was asking them in the times when, over the course of things, you have to pay. So he was trying to figure out what was a reasonable amount to pay for a robot that you would fuck. And the robot that he had made was much less lifelike looking. It was, although he gave it some humanoid, you know, female characteristics, he wasn't trying to make it sort of as flesh-like as possible. It was much more sort of science fiction-y and robotic. And I thought that it was interesting, although there were cultural differences between him and the other guy, and certainly personal differences, that he was much more enthusiastic about the sex. And it really, you know, was sort of resonating.
That
concurred for me with what you were saying.
Did you? Okay. Well, I was just going to say, I think there's a flip side to this. I think it's fascinating, the idea of having sex with inanimate objects or animate objects that aren't identifiably juicy or plump or nice to touch or tangibly kind of similar to human to human sexuality. But I think it's important that scientists, that roboticians, that people who are not just building robots, not just building kind of steam or cyberpunk gizmos, but actually biotechnologists particularly, are educated in how to follow their libidinal impulses to innovation. Because I think that it's as important for them to be turned on by their creations and to feel that it's okay to follow that impulse as it is for people with a penchant for fucking robots to kind of scrape up the litter of scientific innovation that they can access via the internet.
Well, there's an argument to be made that that's the difference between a good and a bad sex toy. I mean, there are plenty of sex toys that are designed by people who don't have any idea about the human body, certainly bodies of other genders than their own. And one of the reasons that they're designing the sex toy is because somebody's paying them wage to do it, but they don't use them, you know? So is it hot for them? A lot of them it's not hot for, or they won't admit it. And you don't get that evocation of hotness from the object that they create. So I think that there's lots of levels of that that are, some of which are a little on the old-fashioned side, and obviously ones that are having to do with technologies that we have barely begun to figure out could be deployed this way. But I wanted to say something else about the robot and the object thing, because I just yesterday got turned on to a woman who is a sexological researcher, and she's writing about something she's calling object sexuality. Her name is Amy Marsh. And I'm going to invite her to come to the Center for Sex and Culture one of these days. So if any of you think this is a hot idea, please get on our email list so I can let you know about it when it happens. But she's looking at a cohort of people who mostly don't have desire for humans. So they might, under other circumstances, identify as asexual, but they don't because they have objects, not all objects that you would think of initially. I immediately thought of, Hitachi magic wands and dildos. Those are very regular in my world. No, she's talking about somebody who has actually married the Eiffel Tower. People who are erotic around objects that many of us would not necessarily pick out of our minds as being erotic objects. And that's pretty fascinating. And as soon as she starts talking about that in any kind of a wide-ranging way, more of those folks are going to show up and talk about it, and we're going to understand more ramifications of sexuality than we did before, because people don't talk about this all that much. I mean, there's and they resist being called fetishists too. That's the other thing that I thought was quite interesting, that there's a tendency of this sort of the old school, and sometimes maybe the those of us who are comfortable with the notion of us being fetishes or being fetishists or being in the fetish community say, oh, well, you've got a fetish then, and they're like, no. It's my sexuality. It's not my fetish. It's who I am. So those differences, I think, are going to be really important as we march forward and have more excellent gizmos that can do more cool things for us or with us.
Tatiana. Yeah, I wanted to say something. I think that maybe a good strategy for the future would be like to think about the present of sexuality and like the question is, for example, how many people outside this room know what we are speaking about and what is their perception of sexuality, in the sense that what is sexuality and pornography for them. So I think that I think it's really fascinating to speak about sex with a machine, but first of all, I think that maybe I found really interesting what you say by the fact that we need really some, also with the soul say, that we need maybe to educate the people to think about sexuality and pornography as an open concept and something that could belong to everybody, not just people that are into some specific community. So speaking about the market as well, I think that's actually with the technology and internet lately, we really arrived to a point that a lot of people are really sharing pornography, but outside the market, in the sense they use peer-to-peer channels and system. So I would say that somehow this is creating a parallel market, because they are not actually creating any kind of capitalism on that, and is really somehow grassroots oriented. So I would say, how is possible that somehow we are able to influence the market that is the one made of stereotypes that we don't like, of course, like more the mainstream pornography, but starting to think about something that like is different, it's like more a contamination of idea and culture, but also be able to bring it out from this room, and not just about people that are really well educated.
I really love the things that you're saying, Tatiana. I think there's no mistake that it's not an accident that Monochrome is involved both with this conference, but also heavily involved with the hackerspace movement, and so and with open open source software, but open culture in general. So as you're talking about works that are being produced outside of the marketplace, outside of capitalism. That is exactly like the things that are going on in hackerspaces, which are not generally pornography, although tomorrow's workshops are all going to be happening at NoiseBridge, which is San Francisco's main hackerspace. Say if the NoiseBridge folks happy. And one definition of hacking that a friend of mine gave is that it's the work that we do, which is just for ourselves. It's not for money, and it's completely outside of the capitalist system.
In fact, I really like that you mentioned hacker culture, because I mean, maybe I should do a bit of background, because I come from Italy, and the For us, I speak about at least the community I'm part of, that is the one more working with art, hacking, and also sexuality. Speaking about this kind of concept, like also queer culture, is really connected with the hacker culture, because it's a way of try to rethink like sexuality in a different way that is not the predictable way like the mainstream sexuality is addressing. And so it's like a flow that is traveling between different identity, different ideas of using your body. So it's like open your body as a hacker could open machine. And in this sense, it's like try to experiment what was is inside and create new category, or go out of category.
Yeah, I just wanted to add quickly too, I think what you're talking about is not necessarily subverting, but changing the idea of what porn's normative culture is through allowing people to sort of open source their own pornography or open source their own images into pornography. And as someone who's been blogging about porn since about 2001, the revolution is already underway. And a lot of that has to do with some of the things we were talking about earlier, and that's that the bar to entry has changed completely in terms of content distribution and content creation in porn. And the DVD is dead and dying, and thank fucking God for that. And what's great about that is that over the past few years, as this method of content delivery has died slowly, people have started making their own porn and distributing it on the internet. And that's why we have all of these great women of color, queer-owned porn companies making their own porn. And yeah, in the background, they have hot queer hacker chicks that work there, that know how to put the sites together and know how to work with the video files and put stuff on the internet. And this revolution has been going on somewhat quietly in the background while mainstream porn has just been churning out more and more of the same old stuff. And we're only now really starting to see it now that people aren't buying DVDs anymore and they're going online for porn. So the revolution in porn is open sourced. It is coming from the people, and you can find it. It's loud. It's out there, and it's really, really exciting. And then the only other thing I wanted to add, too, was to Carol in terms of the woman talking about people sexualizing and having sexual and emotional and romantic relationships with objects. It's not a new thing. I just recently discovered an arena of porn. It's Japanese. It's table porn. It is exclusively about having sex with tables. And there's a lot on BitTorrent. It's excellent. Most of it is clothes on, and it's very, very long segments of girls having orgasms on the corners of tables. So it's not a new thing. It's
IKEA, yes, IKEA. Trip to IKEA.
Is this an invitation?
Tomorrow morning we go to IKEA, and later on we go to Noisebridge, okay? So we have one comment from the audience, Douglas Pink, who gave an interesting talk today about cross-species science fiction literature. But he was first.
Okay. I have to take off to the airport right now, I'm jumping in before the comment period. We have a whole thread in our forum on that object sexuality, which I started tracking a while ago, including some really detailed investigations of a woman who married a roller coaster recently. And that was kind of it actually crossed over into the mainstream in the newspapers and treated very much as, not a fetish sexual orientation. And we usually say, those of us in non-mainstream sexualities, that you wouldn't call somebody who is gay have a fetish. Mm-hmm. It's an orientation, right? So it's, it can feel the same way depending on where you're at. In regards to the discussion about technological sexual items that aren't distinctly human, it's not your imagination. Penthouse just this month did an article about a company based in Scotland that makes very high-end sex toys, not motorized yet, but quite close, actually, that are gendered, sort of, but have absolutely nothing to do with human anything, and in fact don't have anything to do with any mammal anything. It's completely fantasy sex toy, legitimately fantasy sex toy, like high-end. I actually did some consulting work with these guys. Somehow they ended up calling me a couple years ago, and it was just an idea, and this thing just exploded. Like, it's exploded. They can't make as many, as fast as they can. And Penthouse did an article on them, like a front page article.
Can you say what they're called?
Oh, it's called baddragon.com.
Yeah.
You've heard of Bad Dragon?
Jan,
the founder of Bad Dragon, and I sort of started the whole concept just joking around in a meeting. And there it went. So, it's
silicone toys
absolutely.
That are in the shape of fantasy creatures,
right.
like dragon penises that
right.
ejaculate.
And some of them are in the shape of not even pretending to be a creature. Like,
yeah.
they realized that there didn't really have to be a creature attached. Mm-hmm. There's just certain shapes that people really like the shapes. I thought it was going to be initially more decorative stuff. People were going to buy them and probably not really do anything. Some of these things are... honestly, like, they're huge.
Yeah.
And like, okay, well, they're cool to put on a shelf, and they're $300 or $400 a toy. Oh no, they use them, they break them, they want new ones. they sell a lot of them, and they can't grow fast enough. I mean, there's no advertising. They've never advertised, they've never done anything, and it's not the furry community. I mean, there's a little corner of that, but it's something else. It's that sort of post humanist sexuality thing that all of you, I think, have smelled coming. Well, it's here. Like, I mean, it's in Penthouse magazine. They wrote it up. I couldn't believe it when I read it. So unfortunately, I can't really follow up on any of that. But I just wanted to tell you guys that you were ahead of the curve, and the curve's caught up to where you guys were a few years ago, probably, and is accelerating. I mean, I can't even keep up with it now. Jan's doing stuff, and I'm like, whoa, that's weird. And when I say, when I'm like, whoa, that's weird, that's weird, And every day, every week he calls me and says, oh, they've got stuff coming off the pipeline that's like, oh, wow, who came up with that, They can't make it fast enough to sell it. And in terms of the non-mainstream distribution channels, in a similar vein, you guys are absolutely right. Our privacy company started a tracker as an internal testing facility for some of our privacy software. We just needed a tracker back end so we could make sure that it worked. And people started showing up and throwing stuff vaguely cross-species, but mostly just random, not mainstream stuff in this. It's got, what, 17,000 members now, 400 terabytes worth of data that's been sent through, completely non-commercial, non-profit, totally self-organized, out of nowhere. It's made itself, you know, with nobody telling it what to do. A lot of it's created content that people create, mash up, put together. Mm-hmm. Who knows where it comes from? Some of it's sort of carved out of bizarre Japanese subgenres involving, you know, nursing outfits and latex and cleaning supplies. And, you know, okay, there's a name for it, and there's a whole genre, and it's all on our tracker now. You know, somebody's obsessively organized the whole. I mean, it's gone past that mainstream adult world. I mean, it's over that whole making vanilla porn. I think it just got lapped. And if you go to those mainstream conferences, as you've seen, they're just deer in the headlights.
They are. Absolutely.
They have no idea what's going on. And I mean, they're just sitting up there going, well, we need to get more DRM so people don't steal our stuff.
Yeah,
and it's like, nobody's stealing your stuff. They don't want it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nobody wants your stuff. I mean, that's the reality. I mean, you guys could make stuff that people want. You could, because people still want stuff and they'll pay for it. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll give you money for it, even if you're trying to give it away for free. But if you're making what they don't want, you can't force them to buy it. But these guys are honestly, I mean, up to the senior people in the industry, they have gone glassy-eyed. So, I mean, the space is just open. It's really fascinating right now because they've conceded the entire space to whoever will experiment. Mm-hmm. And I think the next 10 years are going to be spectacular because...
It's wide open.
Yeah.
It's wide open. And also just, I'm not to plug another conference, but Video Camp SF on October 16th, mm-hmm. I'll be interviewing as the keynote Ian McKay, who is Vividalt's main director, about the death of the DVD and sitting there watching his product get DRM'd up the ass while he's... watching everyone, you know, he announces his videos on his Twitter stream. He'll be like, here's the BitTorrent for the film that I don't even have out yet, you know, and because he just sees it all, but he can't do anything in the industry. So it'll be an interesting talk. I think it'll echo a lot of what you just said.
And so you mentioned things being DRM'd that can't be given away. That sounds a whole lot like what everybody's dear friend Cory Doctorow talks about. And I wanted to mention Cory Doctorow because in the beginning of Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, of course, the protagonist's mother is a washing machine. And in Glass House, the protagonist begins the book as a tank. The protagonist is sexualized in Glass House as a tank, then goes on to not be a tank at other points in the book. But Douglas was talking about wanting to continue discussion and not being able to. We are going to have a discuss list for Ars Electronica, which I wanted to mention. I asked Johannes to mention, and he said, No, you do it. I just did. What did you do? You want to add a bit?
One more statement.
Okay. I've written a series of articles for XBiz magazine, which is one of the big mainstream porn adult industry publications, and they've really reached out to try to bring, you know, people in to talk to them about what's going on, presented at some of their conferences now. And the DRM thing, they definitely just don't want to hear the reality. They'll actually argue with you about it and get mad. I've had yelling arguments with people. I'm like, whoa, it's not me. You know, I'm not the one. Like, you can't be stealing our content. I don't want your content. They've sort of gone into this death spiral where they're so mad at themselves. But more than that, I've written a number of articles for XBiz, one of which was infamously titled "The Fantastic Future of Porn," where I was envisioning the crossover of CGI past the uncanny valley into mediated scapes where you're not buying CGI movies. You're buying access to CGI worlds that you can mold to how you want it to be. These things are going to burn processor. I mean, right now you could shut down a whole country's processors trying to make these, but the tools are there and it's going to happen and people will pay unbelievable amounts of money for 15 minutes and escape with their special Japanese table porn world with different gravity so they can run up the... I mean, like, people will pay if you can do that, and you can do that right now. It's just that nobody's actually done it. Somebody's going to do it. It's going to be multi-billion dollar industry. And when I started talking about this in the adult world, they just don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it. And I've tried to bring up the questions of ethics and legality and, like, how is this going to happen when somebody populates an ethical, you know, escape with children? it's going to happen. Like, what's the industry going to do? And they just go deer in the headlights. They don't want to talk about it. But somebody's going to have to start talking about this, because it's going to, the market's going to lead. It's already leading itself. And I think it behooves any collection like the people here to take that seriously, because it's not going to be the industry that does it. They've just, you know, gone further and further into that California market, and they're, you know, hoping somebody will bail them out, really. Mm-hmm.
So. There's one. In the first years, Ars Electronica, like in 2007, SF Slim, Aaron Musalski, he's there, yeah? He gave a talk about random porn and stuff like that, and he was telling the story about the American remake of Lolita, where the main character, Lolita, she was under 16, so it was not possible to film any nude scenes with her. So they copy-pasted pretty much like the breasts of some 18-year-old girl onto her, so they could actually create like a nude scene and stuff like that. So there's lots of things going on there in the realm of like render porn. So if you create render porn, like render child pornography, is this child pornography or not? So necrophilia, whatever. It, like, the sky is the limit, I say, or hell or whatever. And but that actually would bring me to one question, because we are talking about the future of sexuality and porn here. So there's maybe that's a little bit strong, but I try to emphasize it, okay? So there's the one side of the globe that's like the Western liberal world, where there will be like, and there's stuff happening we couldn't imagine. There's like this, like, there's a, like a liberal society, and if you can pay for it, it will happen, yeah? And there's this other part of the globe where like women are still in a certain way forced to wear like headscarves and stuff like that. So if you're talking about the future of sex, so how does that like, how does this like acceleration or deacceleration of like cultures like go into this whole? I don't know. So I'll just like drop that into the round now.
But still, I would say in US pornography is prostitution. Sorry, not pornography, is considered illegal. So I think there is still something to do here as well, because also the right of the sex workers is a big issue here. So. Mm-hmm.
I think the cultural divide there isn't nearly as sharp as you're making it out. I think that specifically looking at the Muslim world, there's a much sharper division between what is appropriate in the public sphere and what is appropriate in the private sphere, where they have a much stronger enforcement of this kind of public morality in public, but that's a very, very thin shell around a society that's much, much more diverse than we see, because we only see the public sphere. You know, they're not going to let the TV news crew into the house. That's sort of the point. I mean, there's this, you know, amazingly diverse market in like animatronic lingerie in Iran. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's actually a lot more complicated. And yes, there is a lot of heteronormative power structure around that kind of sexuality, but there is still a lot more diversity there. And given the kinds of cultural repression that we see in the West, I don't think that the West is that much more free in a lot of ways. You know, I think it really is a continuum. I don't think you can't really put a line there. It's like saying that, oh, there's the first world and the third world. That isn't really true anymore, and it hasn't been true for a while.
I mean, it's interesting that especially in Iran, Iran is the country with the most like you know, like plastic surgery kind of thing. So like it's the country, it's the top country for like female plastic surgery, like doing lips and noses and stuff like that. And then it's an interesting thing to reflect that they're in a certain way like hindered to show themselves, but like behind the walls and what they are doing to their body. That's an interesting thing. And that's actually why I wanted to go there, because talking about the future, talking about body modification, stuff like that, we see it in different cultures in different ways. That's why I wanted to actually like pop it into, like, as a devil's advocate, that's why I wanted to pop it into the discussion here. And you were actually shaking your head almost as mad when I like told the story about this like diversion between like the two worlds that we live in. But
You said it.
Okay, good. Yeah. That's fine. So
you know, I also want to say it's almost not like a continuum. It's almost like a pixelation where every culture's got highly sexual people, sexual adventurers, whether or not they're open about it, whether or not they can be open about it. I'm on the judging board for the Sex Positive Journalism Award, and one of the pieces that won last year was about sex parties in Iran, like home-based sex parties, and it was an enormously fascinating article. And I just bought a book about Syrian lingerie for the Center for Sex and Culture Library last night. See, it's all coming together. But it seems to me that this notion that some cultures reinforce liberal exploration is, I mean, that's so philosophically as far as it goes, but there are plenty of people who aren't coming along with that notion, and there's no place more obvious than the United States right now.
The Syrian lingerie book is an astonishing book. Cool. I would absolutely recommend that you look that up in a bookstore, and it's worth actually holding and looking through. The thing I want to follow up on what you're saying, Carol, is that here in the United States, I think that is very, very easy for us to lose track of in a room like the room we are in, that we can't talk about a monoculture in referring to a country. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous to talk about Iran or Muslims or even the United States. Mm-hmm. My rights as, you know, someone who's kinky or poly or perverted or genderqueer or whatever, that I feel perfectly free expressing here, just don't exist in the same way if I were to, you know, show up in Gonzales, Louisiana. You know, and I would have to express myself very differently if I wanted to feel safe. And so there's issues of safety, but then also issues of propriety. Like, how much do I want to be in someone else's face with my expression of self? Our cultural norms across the country are very diverse. So that was one point I wanted to make, but then another, Carol is very fertile thought material for me, and always has been for such a long time. I am a Carol groupie. Harry, I'm sitting so close to her. Carol said earlier a lot of really amazing stuff about women looking at male-oriented porn, is to say porn which is generated with men in mind. And I'm guessing that the first thought you had there was porn which had men and women fucking mm-hmm. in it. One thing that has been true for a very long time is that women have been interested in gay male porn. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about Slash, or when we think just about women getting access to gay male porn, there's an interest there in looking at porn, gay male porn, for the same reasons that men sometimes like to look at lesbian porn. There are no men in lesbian porn, and so men get to just look at women fucking. And there are no women, and women get to just look at men fucking. So that's a way of choosing to look at porn which was not intended for you, but which satisfies a desire that you have, right? Yeah. And those are things that have been going on for as long as there's porn. You get to make choices about what porn you consume, even if the porn wasn't made for you.
Yeah. The one thing I would add to that is that the other thing that you're doing and able to do when you're looking at two people of supposedly the same gender, or as far as you can tell by looking at them on a screen, the same gender, because mm-hmm. you don't necessarily know for sure that that's how they are going to identify, is that you can identify yourself with either or both of them in a way that is a little harder, not impossible, certainly, but harder if you're looking at heterosexual porn. And I think that's another of the reasons that it's attractive. Same-sex porn is attractive. This notion that I came up with under feminism, that the reason men wanted to watch girl-girl porn, as it is always talked about in the industry, is that they want to imagine themselves to be the only man in the room, is sometimes, in fact, that he wants to imagine himself female in the room with them, mm-hmm. and wants to imagine himself with his male identity, but not having the kind of male oriented or male categorized sex that men are taught to have. So it's, you've got to break it down so carefully and really listen to individual people's thoughts about this kind of stuff. I'm glad you said that.
I wanted to bring it back and react to what you had to say, Johannes, because actually I was the one that was vigorously shaking their head over
okay,
here.
Okay,
so.
Okay.
It's okay. what I thought was really interesting about what you said, and then Carol touched on it, talking about the pixelation of sexuality, and then you touched on it, Rose, talking about sexuality and context. In terms of what you said with sex in different cultures and thinking about sex in the future, is that you sort of touched on what a lot of people have when they imagine sexual freedom and the lack of in other cultures. And there's this sort of feeling of overall sexual xenophobia that I think is starting to emerge in a lot of the conversation that I'm hearing. Mm-hmm. And especially with, and I forget the gentleman's name that was sitting here earlier, he was talking about, you know, being an ex-biz and talking about, you know, the, you know, future sort of Second Life style worlds and how anything can go and people are just going to act crazy and there's going to be worlds full of, you know, children getting raped and stuff like that. And this is this sort of sexual hysteria that I keep hearing over and over again. That's a sort of underlying fear about what sex in the future is like. It's the same sort of xenophobia that you were talking about, you know. And the answer is really in the contextualizing that both you two were doing, you three actually. And I was kind of looking at Kyle in the back a little bit because he used to work at Linden Labs. And I think that, you know, not to, you know, beat a dead horse with Second Life. However, there are people that work there that I work with at San Francisco Sex Information. We worked the hotlines together for years. It's a very actually sex positive organization in the background. And it's a self-rectifying culture in many ways. It's self-moderated. And it's a very interesting example of when a culture is allowed to do what it does within the parameters of anything can go and seeing what happens. And people haven't gone crazy and shot up their families at home, and they haven't like gone off and fucked a million sheep, or they haven't turned into Philip Garridos, who are already that way, you know, and probably don't have access to things like Second Life or whatever to go and express their sexuality. So it's this hysterical idea that, you know, once anything can go with sex in the future, once we can fuck anything or disappear into our own worlds, or once we have a chip implant where we have orgasms on tap, are we just going to, you know, turn into these drooling blobs in the corner in the dark, just sitting there pressing the button like the rat waiting for the cheese to fall out until we're so fat our stomachs explode? You know, it's like, I don't think so, because we're human and each culture has its context and each facet of sexual expression has its context. And there's always some part of culture that's going to moderate that and help shape that so that it's in its proper context one way or another. So don't fear the future.
To go along with what you're saying, technology isn't new. The idea of technology being the thing we don't know about, the thing that's going to happen, that then is going to produce this pedophilia or whatever,
insert fear
into this blank. Jason Scott gave an amazing talk about technology in relationship to porn, and gave us examples of typewriter porn. And porn being transmitted over ham radio. And we have, at the CSC library, at the Kinsey Institute library, we have examples of porn collected over the entire course of, you know, human events. And when we look at that porn, we do not see a high percentage of pedophiliac porn, right? And there's no reason to assume that as we adopt new technologies, what we as human beings will want will suddenly change. Or at least I don't think so. I agree with you completely.
So, go ahead. If you've got something to respond to that.
I wanted to address, so one of the things that we have been talking about a bit, though, is, you know, people using these technologies to get exactly what they want, you know, being able to customize to exactly what they desire, being able to use these technologies to reach out and find other people. And I think that's one of the cases where we are already seeing technology changing society a lot. And I think it's somewhere where it's very clearly accelerating. Look at the community in this room. Look at the talk earlier today on the internet enabling polyamory. These are good things for the most part, but it is really driving this kind of very culturally siloed culture shift, where we're getting all of these cultures which may be overlaid in physical space, but they're not really communicating. You know, there isn't that kind of spatially related cultural bond. You end up like, you know, I come to San Francisco, I meet the people who are part of a very specific subculture. There are, you know, however many other million people in the Bay Area, they don't exist. You know, I don't interact with them in any meaningful way. And it is becoming increasingly easy to do that. I'm not saying that this is necessarily a bad thing, but that's a really big shift in terms of how people interact with culture. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see what that does, you know, rolled forward 50 years, rolled forward 100 years.
I kind of wanted to ask a stupid question which relates to that, really, which is, what is porn for? And what are we using it for? Because all of the experiments and the extrapolations on pornography and autoerotic imagery and constructions or sexual augmentation, in the most part, has been talked about in relation to masturbation of various kinds. I mean, you can call it what you want, but it just seems to be generating a lot of wanking. And I'm interested in pornography because, in the same way that I'm interested in science fiction, and I actually didn't really like Douglas Spink's talk and his positioning of these science fiction writers on this two-dimensional grid, because I think what science fiction does is provides us with a mindset or a position from which to look at innovation or society or technological development that's really at right angles to the current market trajectories of technology. And what's exciting to me about pornography, especially about non-human porn or non-human sexual devices in erotica, is that it's like there's this whole skill set or whole set of aptitudes that's developed within this community that could completely transform the way that people approach all kinds of activities, you know, academic papers. You know, some people could start feeling aroused by the particular phrasing of their academic work and then develop a sort of ability to judge, okay, I'm doing something right here because I've got a hard on, or you know, or whatever they're doing, you know, any kind of activity, any kind of creative activity could be given this extra dimension of motivation. So that's kind of why I'm interested in it. And I hope that can happen. I hope that the imagination in the room and to some extent what Tatiana was saying beforehand can expand to start sex education, not to make people have safer sex or liberate their personal desires, but actually transform the way that they live their lives and imagine their futures.
Maybe that's another component that we need to start adding to sex education is like sexual interpretation, you know, how to interact with someone who has radically different sex than you in whatever dimension, you know, so that, you know, kind of as a way to combat that sort of xenophobia and kind of just as a, like, you know, here's how to understand someone who gets off really differently than you. They're not that weird, you know, whether it's going from the mainstream to what we think of the fringes or, you know, maybe us out here on the fringes saying, oh yeah, okay, those you know, quote, vanilla people, yeah, I can sort of, you know, I can get that, I can understand that, you know, they're not that weird.
And also wanted to say something. I think maybe the real challenge is how to make porn close to our daily life. And then I think that should be our objective. Then there are different possibility and different strategy to use to achieve this point. And so I think it's not really a matter of if the technology are new or not. I mean, you could actually do that using Second Life or maybe the ASCII porn that we saw yesterday. So what was important of this is that actually was a possibility for the people to get close to this topic and to actually do it part of the daily life. Like you say, have the sex machine in a museum so everybody can go there and fuck the machine. So that should be the objective for the next Ars Electronica.
So, okay, let get me like a telephone number of the Museum of Modern Art here and we'll do that next year.
Just to follow up on the notion of learning how to relate to people who have a very different sexual practice than oneself. I mean, this is something that I think is what brings a lot of people into the kinky or the poly communities, is they realize that they're in a relationship with someone who might have a very different practice, and they don't want to leave the relationship. So then they have to learn how to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's something that actually is already getting discussed quite a bit in an informal way. And it probably would be very helpful to have more organized kind of, you know, education about, you know, and to make it more okay. Because one thing that seems like it's becoming increasingly clear is that there are many, many people in relationships where they're pretty unhappy because they're not really very compatible in some way. And that's not really recognized as a serious and legitimate issue. You know, if you're not happily compatible in some kind of heterosexual monogamous relationship, well, you know, somebody is a failure there. Rather than it just being, oh, this is just something that happens. And people don't learn to find out about it ahead of time so that they can decide how to negotiate that, you know, as part of the normal process of a relationship.
Vanilla people need checklists too.
Yes.
Oh, that's for sure. Sometimes even more. You know, I really want to say that I think that speaking from the radical sexology perspective, that there is already a profound degree of knowledge about this stuff in the sex education that we give on a community basis, on a community inflected and influenced basis. It just, when you started to speak, what I wanted to say was, what sex education? You know, we all have taken sex education into our hands talk about hacking. We have had to hack the culture around sexuality, and this is going to continue to need to happen. As long as these cultural notions about sexuality and its use stay as polarized as they are. Thank you, Catholics, who are calling me a pedophile right now. Many of you were here last night when we said that, but if any of you were not, can I just say, the Catholics are calling anybody a pedophile? Please, please, please. Oh, it's just so complicated. But what I want to say about this is that there was just a few days ago an op-ed that I read somewhere. It was in the UK, actually, I think, a UK paper, about a book that's come out recently asking women why they have sex. And there were like 234 reasons. And they actually admitted that there probably were a few more reasons that they just hadn't gleaned. But the notion that there are only a few reasons for somebody to have sex in the first place with another person, much less with yourself. I mean, I think that starts to get at what you were talking about, Saul, that there are so many different directions to come from to get to what might seem like the same place, but then if you come from radically different enough directions, it's not the same place at all. It's the same act, but it's two different reasons for doing it. It has different meanings, and we can all think of at least three relationships that we've been in that broke up for that exact reason right there, because nobody taught us to have that discussion. And because pornography has always been sought out as a source of sex education, even though it all sometimes does that in a phenomenally shitty way, sometimes better than that, but sometimes in just a phenomenally shitty way. Although I blame the pornography of Andrew Blake, where the woman stood up and put her leg all the way up in the air to get fucked in the early mid 90s for the yoga studio explosion that subsequently happened. Personally, I'm just telling you right now, that's what I think happened. So who knows what's going to happen next? Who knows what the next pornography is going to unleash upon the cultures? I think it's really important to say, no matter what we talk about, if we call it pornography, somebody's going to reach out to it to get inspiration, support, permission to see the thing itself. That's always going to happen unless the cultures replace pornography with something else. And so far, many of our cultures have not done that very successfully.
We're talking here about pornography as sexual education, and then we're talking also about sexual education more broadly as a way of improving relationships and relationship styles. But Saul was talking about sexual education as getting to the heart of what education is. I found that very exciting. Speaking as an academic, but as someone who has a very ambivalent relationship to traditional academia, one of the reasons I have that ambivalent relationship is because I'm so passionate about the idea of teaching. And there's a sort of you could call it a dirty secret, which is that in the teaching act, you're sort of channeling that that eros of the teacher and the student, of, you know, the relationship between the people, the learning and the teaching, right? And then what you were then also referring to is that excitement, which we channel, we intellectualize, and don't call real excitement. We don't call physical sexualized excitement. We say it's, you know, it's excitement of the mind. We don't, you know, we don't say like, oh, that makes me wet. We don't say that makes me hard. We don't say that turns me on. And so you were talking then about the kind of, say, sex machines that are made and the, say, electronic tinkering that goes on. And you referred to it as being, you know, the litter of scientific education. That it's that you sort of the people who are willing to say, this turns me on and I want to do the tinkering, are not necessarily, although sometimes they are, you know, our top-notchest engineers. And I think that was what you were trying to get at, that if we could be perhaps more open about our sexual motivations, our fullest drives in whichever pursuit we're in, then, you know, the sky's the limit. And that was what I think Tatiana was talking about too, that if our pornographic sort of interest, if our, you know, sexual imagination could be part of our everyday imagination, that so now.
Yeah, I'm totally. Yeah, well, no, that's exactly what I was kind of grasping at, because it seemed to be in the air, this idea of libidinizing education or libidinizing innovation in all kinds of fields. And I love the idea of the fuckable art show. Yes. I think that's a great idea. And I similarly think, you know, where's the, you know, how could you have sex with the CERN collider? There's all these kinds of tantalizing opportunities. Once you've libidinized all these professions and different career options, and suddenly it's like everything can take advantage of the more kind of interpersonal issue politic revolutions that have happened in San Francisco most of all, and then in the rest of the world. You know, that's transformed people's relationships themselves and their bodies, and that could just go so much further, and it's in fact these communities that could take that kind of libidinal energy and distribute it to all these other communities of creative people.
So, I mean, I promise. I had sex with an overhead projector like 3 years ago or 4 years ago. Yeah, actually, I had sex with the overhead projector because I wanted to prove its pornographic possibility. So I actually ejaculated on the overhead projectors. Yeah, it's on the web. Yeah, you can. It's actually on YouPorn, and it has like a 3.75 rating out of 5. So it's not bad. I am. It's the only piece of myself on YouPorn so far, and it's like, I mean, you know, YouPorn is like 95. They pretend that they are amateur porn, but like 95% is just like some like copied from some other porn site. Okay, but the problem is, I didn't like having sex with the overhead projector. I did it because I had to do it. Okay, and I need to. I only once. Yes, my first time, and that's the point. That's what I'm saying. I need to get like I have to get the drive. I guess, yeah. So I promise to have sex with maybe another overhead projector, maybe some table, object, whatever. So I promise until next year I will have sexual intercourse with at least 40 or 45 different objects. I promise.
That's
so
good. No, because if you're goal oriented, your first time it will be disappointing.
A sex toy marathon.
I will Twitter it. Wow. Okay. And so how to have sex with the super collider? I just really quickly, I had an idea. One of the fucking machines last year was some sort of bicycle. Does anybody remember was it sort of a two-person bicycle? Did it actually move as a bicycle?
No. It had gears, and it had a dildo that went up and down in the seat.
Yeah. If it could move as a tandem bicycle, I know that the Super Collider, like, people use the bicycle to get around the Super Collider because it's really, like, it's long, because it has to be long because the atoms have to go far. So you could sort of have some kind of tandem bike or single bike or, you know, something like that.
Johannes, so do you need to have a more sexual head projector designed?
He's a Brit.
He's like, I can fuck the Super Collider.
Yes. So I think we should try to find a hashtag now for, like, I think that all of you should have sex with an object in the future, okay? So I think we should find a hashtag, and it's just like table and the hashtag, and everybody knows, I mean, what's going on, okay? So just for okay? And maybe
should be sponsored by IKEA.
Yeah. maybe the hashtag would be, I don't know. What could
table or something?
No. It could actually be something like a paragraph, dollar paragraph, or something, like really, just like almost like a secret code,
something discreet,
a very discreet code. Like, we can think about that, and we'll blog it on the Ars Electronica homepage, I guess. Yeah.
So,
how about hashtag dollar sign table? Because table is sort of standing in for whichever object. Is that too geeky?
One more time.
So hashtag dollar sign table. Because table is sort of standing in for whichever object. It's a variable. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I know that's very geeky.
It's okay, you're surrounded by geeks. It's okay.
We could do an open contest. We could do an open contest and see which proposal.
To find a hashtag? Come on. what? Okay. So we have already been talking like over an hour, I see. But I want to, like, that's something I would be really interested in, is could we do a brainstorming here, like all of us, about, because we are talking about like the hypercrotch, the nanobot, the future of sex. If you could invent something right now, or if you could change something on your body or on somebody else's body, what would you do? So what would, like, what kind of, like, new gadget or new body modification, whatever it is, what would you think would be cool and why?
I would say, I don't know what is the object, but to be something that make me laugh in the midway I have sex, because I think it should be ironic and a pleasure that is also kind of a game, something hilarious. I don't know. I will think about.
Okay. Okay.
Is anybody else ready for their thoughts?
Tough question.
Oh. Okay. They're frowning. I have been very interested that disability has come up a few times over the course of the conference. I'm sort of invisibly disabled. I have rheumatoid arthritis, and I do use a cane, but you can't see right now that I use a cane. What would I do? I would not have arthritis, but whatever. As we start, I was really struck by some things Ella was saying, and of course some things Annalie was saying about, you know, what sort of prosthetic things we might have, or if we could, you know, pick our legs at will, or our arms at will. Like, this hand is nice. I know how to use this hand, but, you know, I can pick the other hand.
Okay.
Yeah. I have a set of hands.
Well, I've been, I can kind of cheat on this question, because I've been spending the past couple of weeks thinking about, you know, what I would invent, what I would, you know, change.
You swatted up.
And I think my favorite of all of the fictions I threw out this morning was skin grafts that are based on cephalopod chromatophores that change organically in response to your emotions. So you have this completely new affective channel. You have body language But you also, like, well, you turn pink when you're embarrassed, and you turn black when you're angry, and, you know, you turn spotted when you're horny. So that's what I'd like.
Saul?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, my old fantasy is to have a prehensile tail. I think there are an awful lot of sexual uses for a prehensile tail. Excellent. But I also want to say that there was a person who came up with such a great idea that I want to just repeat it to you because I have adopted it since I heard it, which was the Good Vibes Millennium Sex Toys You Wish Existed contest. And somebody pitched all the way out in the middle of the millennium, I think, and wants, and I'm sure somebody's working on this too. In fact, I'd totally love to hear what you people think is close to this versus far. To be able to record your own sexual experiences and play them back later, so re-experience them, and ideally to be able to allow someone else to plug in, however that's going to be, and experience the same sexual experience that you've experienced. I think it would revolutionize practically everything. Personally.
It was like early 1980s brainstorm, like Christopher Walken and Natalie Wood, I guess. And they have this like scene where someone dies, or actually his brain gets fried or something like that. Because the cool thing is back then, 1980s, they used like tape, so they had like very thick like tape to record the brain waves, and he glued together. He'd use tape to make a loop of the piece of tape with the orgasm recorded. So we had this like ongoing like analog tape loop, and I think it goes on for a couple of hours, and then his brain is pretty much like gone or something. But okay, yeah, Brainstorm, actually a really good film. You should all check it out. It's somewhere on Pirate Bay, I guess.
Okay, I was reminded earlier on today when there was some earlier talk about interspecies sex of the fact that bacterial sex is now seen as one of the primary transmitters of genetic information between humans, not necessarily sexual reproduction, but the exchange of mitochondrial DNA through infection. And I'd love to be able to feel that, develop some new kind of nervous tissues or senses so that all the things that were constantly having sex within me, or like when I caught a cold or when I got some sort of horrible disease, that I'd actually be able to experience pleasurable feelings or some kind of feelings other than just getting a blocked nose.
Okay. Well, I am nothing if not a practical girl. And taking into consideration what everyone has said, first, Carol read my mind, and I've thought of a couple of things while everyone's been talking. One is that the first thing I thought of was the ability to record the porn that I see with my eyes when I go to these things that I go to, when I go on set to people's porn films, or when I visit the kink.com castle. I see amazing things that I can't really record or talk about. Sometimes they let me take photos. But if I could record that and have some mental space that I go to, that's a private space that I share with my community, where I can share what I've seen, that would be awesome. And then the other practical thing, actually there's three practical tips here. So the other thing, I was so pissed off when they stopped the research on Viagra for women, because it totally fucking works for girls. And they discontinued the research saying that women are more interested in romantic fantasy than physiological stimulation. And I was like, fuck you and your mother. I've tried Viagra. I had this great gay doctor. And I was like, what's that stuff like? And he's like, honey, take some home. And I did. And the problem was, is that with Viagra and Cialis and the other things that I've tried, I have allergies. I'm a geek. I use an inhaler sometimes. It makes my nose so stuffy that it's just not fun. But it works. It's like, say, if you can think of your arousal in three stages, skip one, you're halfway through two, and that's what it feels like for girls, because we have the same erectile tissue that it acts on in men. So it works great, stuffs up my nose, fucking finish the research, and get me a pill I can use, because I want the female sex pill. I agree. It doesn't work on all men either. So.
Oh, come here. Tell us. Come here.
That was what was in the press releases that they put out.
Okay. Tell us. I'm really interested because it's an interesting story.
Women's arousal systems are supposedly too complicated.
Oh, God. Nice.
And in one sense, it's true, because not every woman keys into what you're keying into when the blood starts flowing down there. You feel it. For you, that's a signal for arousal. It's not a signal for every woman, and that's where it gets complicated. So for some women, pink Viagra works. For other women, something else, a different fillip. That's sort of my specialty.
Yeah, it's the same stratum with men as well. So yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. And then the third thing I wanted to add was actually something about the title of Hypercrotch and Nanobot, which is if your hypercrotch does contract nanobots, it's a 1 to 3 day lapse in time when they start to manifest. You get it from skin to skin contact. Go see the rubber nurse at kink.com. She has a salve just for you.
Yeah. Okay, so I have many things I would like to have. Most of them are so perverted that I will not talk about it here. I think I have to invent a different conference to talk about that. But there's at least one thing I really would like to have, and it's actually derived from an idea out of Ian Banks' novel Matter. It came out last year, and Ian Banks is like the godfather of this conference, because I wrote this opening paragraph about Ars Electronica and talking about his fictitious group civilization called Culture, that's pretty much like an open, like anarchist socialist civilization, and they are pretty open about their sex, and they are all changing their bodies all the time and stuff. It's pretty good. So if you should not know Ian Banks, and if you should not know the books about the Culture, please buy all of them and read them. They're really great. And then the last one, The Matter, there is this female special agent, and she pretty much has a small drone, and it's her friend and her companion and stuff like that. And at one point, the drone has to hide or in a certain way disguise itself, and it disguises itself as a dildo. And I kind of like the idea of having like a super intelligent dildo or butt plug. I want to have a good conversation with my butt plug. That's what I want to have. That's kind of like it's not completely my idea, but I think I can take that, and the rest is concerning stuff like injecting stuff into my bloodstream and but okay, talk about that later. Any questions from the audience before we close the panel? Okay, yes, no problem.
Actually, it's not a question, it's an offer. Okay. I run an erotic literary salon, so I'm basically working with people like you were mentioning. You know, we're a select group here. We're used to hearing all the words we're hearing and all the ideas. I'd say the majority of people that come to my salon for the first time are venturing into an area that they have no idea where they're going. Most of the time, they don't tell anybody they're going there. And then eventually, maybe they'll even bring in a friend or a family member. One person has been writing a novel for 5 years, and he said if his wife ever knew, she'd divorce him immediately. And some people, this is the only place they can come comfortably to talk about it. So I'm offering them as a sample group for anyone who would like to run things by the quote-unquote normal folks out of Philadelphia.
Any more comments or questions or... Oh, yes. Oh, please come up. Mr. Makepeace. Or did you want to stay anonymous? Okay, whatever.
No, it's fine. Yeah, so I've often noticed that people spend a lot of money on lasering and plucking and waxing, and then they have a pattern, and then it's kind of like, oh, I want to change this. How about having programmable pube patterns? And you can specify preference for your partner, and then you can kind of come up and, you know, it's like a Brazilian, or it's really bushy, or whatever. Okay. That would just save a lot of time and pain. I don't know, like, especially Eastern Europeans, I don't know, it's like a lot thicker and gets harder, so, oops. You could even change, like, the bore of the thickness, depending on, like, whether you were, like, rough and scratchy or kind of soft and feathery. Anyway, so, yeah. I mean, you could even carry, a whole portfolio of pew patterns around with a USB stick. So, yeah, I think there's many things. Maybe even Amazon could store a preference or, you know, Google cookie or something.
I just want to say, before you leave, Sal, I just want to say I really like your fantasy about how you can get sexually aroused by every activity that's going on inside your body, whether it's an infection or cells dividing or something like that. And there's probably some psychedelic drugs out there that could be slightly modified to do that right now, you know, LSD-based or something like that, because then all of a sudden you really become aware of your entire body, and any one mitochondria action will just make you go, whoa.
Okay, so any final statements? No? Not really?
Let's keep them open.
That's right. I guess we have to save some questions for, I hope, next year's Ars Electronica, I guess. So a big applause for the panel, please. And, well, there's a really good friend of me sitting right there. And Jonathan, please come here, come here. Okay, so because it's not the end of today's Ars Electronica. First of all, tomorrow we have the whole day of workshops. Do it yourself, build your own steampunk vibrator. Go to the homepage, check it out. There's so many interesting workshops today, starting 12 noon until probably 9 p.m. in the evening at Noise Bridge. There will be a Tantra workshop and whatever you can imagine. Go there and enjoy, okay? And today, starting at 10 o'clock, actually at 11 o'clock, I would say, we want you to get some dinner and stuff. So let's say 11 o'clock, we'll start at the Femina Potence Gallery. It's the Ars Electronica party, so let's get drunk and let's enjoy a couple of good performances. And Jonathan Mann is an excellent musician, and he will tell you now what he's doing all the time and why he will have an acoustic guitar performance at the Femina Potence Gallery of all instruments, the acoustic guitar.
Well, I guess what Johannes wants me to talk about is, I've been writing a song a day since January 1st, 2009, and so today was 276. And for the last week, I've been trying to put all my efforts into writing sort of sex technology-based songs for this performance this evening, so hopefully that will keep you somewhat entertained. And it was going to be with my full band, but unfortunately the gallery said that I couldn't have drums, so I just put the kibosh on the whole thing and decided to do a solo set. So hopefully it'll be a lot of fun, and I hope you guys can come.
Okay. Jonathan Mann and his acoustic sex tech songs, 11 o'clock at Femina Potence. Rainer Prohaska will be there too, who will be doing the workshop tomorrow about building your own sex devices out of household appliances and electric toothbrushes and stuff like that. So he will have a performance there too. And we will have this wonderful person here. Come on, stand up and tell a little bit about what you will be doing today.
Okay. Hello, my name is Sam Coniglio. I'm, amongst many hats that I wear, I'm a vice president of the Space Tourism Society. Some of you may or may not know a guy by the name of Guy Laliberte is in orbit right now. The first clown in space. He was the founder of Cirque du Soleil. So very exciting. It's very exciting to have clowns in space. But one of the things we do with the society is we research designs of the future for actual people living, working, and playing, emphasize playing in space. If we actually have real vacations and eventually the prices go down, we have real space hotels and people actually can have fun in space. And so one of the big issues is sex. Oh my God. And one of the biggest things everybody asks about, for the Zero Gravity Corporation and for Space Adventures is, can I have sex in space? Yeah. And right now the answer is no.
What?
I know. Because there are certain political reasons, mainly because NASA doesn't think astronauts have sex. So astronauts are not people, they're robots. They do jobs.
That's NASA's perspective on people in space. They're robots, okay? But
I know.
That's why we have to educate these people that there, you know, there is another way and that there are other opportunities. And so one of the things I'm going to talk about is sex in space, and I brought a prototype. It's a rough prototype of what I call a snuggle tunnel. Because one of the biggest problems in zero gravity is, you know, laws of physics for every action equal and opposite reaction and all that type of thing. So I have just a rough prototype I brought up. It went on national television on the History Channel last December. We had a whole show on sex and space on the History Channel, so it's kind of fun. Anyways, I have it with me, and we'll show it off tonight.
Okay. So let's hear songs. Let's build our own sex devices. Let's snuggle in the space thingy. Tunnel, the space tunnel, let's, yeah, whatever. I hope to see you there around 11-ish, the Femina Potens Gallery at 2199, something like that, Market Street. It was a pleasure having you here. Thanks a lot, and I hope to see you again.